In a world where 8.33% of middle and high schoolers drink monthly and drug overdoses have quadrupled among young adults in the past decade, Jessica Leahy's powerful narrative strikes at the heart of modern parenting anxieties. As a recovering alcoholic with 8 years of sobriety, Leahy transforms her personal struggle into a compelling guide that has resonated with parents nationwide. Since its 2021 release, The Addiction Inoculation has become required reading in parenting circles, with celebrities like Reese Witherspoon and Brené Brown championing its approach. The book's cultural impact stems from its revolutionary premise. Addiction prevention isn't about scaring kids straight, but building resilience from early childhood. What makes this work particularly timely is its release during the pandemic, when substance use surged among both adults and adolescents. Leahy's compassionate yet evidence-based approach offers something increasingly rare in our polarized world: hope grounded in science. The human relationship with intoxicating substances dates back to civilization's dawn. Beer, historians suggest, helped transform hunter-gatherer societies into organized civilizations 10,000, 12,500 years ago, serving as liquid courage that eased social anxiety as human settlements grew more complex. This pattern continues today. Many addicts describe their first drink as the solution that made them feel like they belonged. America's founding is similarly intertwined with alcohol. The Pilgrims brought more beer than water on the Mayflower. Throughout early American history, children drank alongside parents from infancy. Babies received alcohol drops on the tongue, toddies drank toddies, and children as young as 12 ordered brandy in taverns. Alcohol served as both beverage and medicine, treating everything from teething pain to broken limbs. Our understanding of addiction has evolved dramatically. When children witness relatives drunk but are told they're taking a nap, this gaslighting makes them question reality. Susan Cheever, daughter of alcoholic writer John Cheever, likens alcoholism to an elephant in the living room that everyone pretends isn't there, making children crazy. Modern terminology has shifted to substance use disorder and person-first language, though many in recovery still identify as alcoholics, finding the term clear, unequivocal, honest, and blunt. The adolescent brain is uniquely vulnerable to substance damage. While newborns arrive with most of their 100 billion neurons, these cells can't communicate effectively yet. Brain development progresses from primitive, lower structures to complex, higher ones over 25 years. The lower brain and limbic system develop first, controlling basic functions, movement, emotions, and memory. The frontal and prefrontal cortex, responsible for planning, prioritizing, and weighing complex risk-reward scenarios, won't fully connect until the mid-20s, a process called frontalization. This creates a developmental gap. Teens' limbic system, driving independence, risk-taking, and sensation-seeking, operates at full capacity, while their prefrontal cortex, responsible for planning, caution, and rational thought, remains underdeveloped. This neurological mismatch explains many frustrating teenage behaviors and creates vulnerability to substance abuse. Adolescent behavior is largely driven by dopamine, the neurotransmitter that motivates us to seek rewards. Teens have lower baseline dopamine levels than children or adults, making everyday life seem boring, but they experience more intense responses when dopamine is released. This explains why teens seek thrilling, risky experiences. Unfortunately, drugs and alcohol hijack this reward system, causing unnaturally high dopamine spikes followed by crashes below baseline levels. With repeated use, the brain adapts by producing less dopamine naturally, eventually requiring the substance just to feel normal. Despite declining rates of teen alcohol use, adolescents drink differently than adults. They binge drink more frequently and process alcohol differently. Teens experience alcohol's positive effects more intensely while feeling negative effects less acutely. This dangerous combination means teens don't recognize when they've had too much. Girls face higher risks due to physiological differences that result in 30% higher blood alcohol concentrations than boys drinking the same amount. Alcohol damages developing brains structurally and functionally, shrinking the hippocampus and killing gray matter in the frontal lobe. Blackouts, complete memory gaps from events never recorded, affect 40% of college students and can signal higher addiction risk. Even moderate drinking damages adolescent brains, leading experts to recommend zero tolerance rather than harm reduction approaches for teens. Unlike other substances, nicotine use is increasing among teens, with 21% of high schoolers using e-cigarettes in 2018, a 38% jump from the previous year. Nicotine delivers immediate cognitive rewards and creates powerful addictive rituals. Adolescents develop nicotine dependence more rapidly than adults. Despite deaths from vaping-related lung disease, many teens continue using, incorrectly believing removal of vitamin E acetate has eliminated all risks. Adolescent brains are uniquely vulnerable to marijuana's adverse effects, particularly regarding learning and memory. The brain has natural receptors for THC concentrated in the hippocampus, explaining why memory impairment is marijuana's most notorious side effect. Studies show THC causes significantly worse memory impairment in adolescents than adults, with effects persisting even for occasional users. Heavy use increases hippocampal gray matter volume, likely from disrupted neural pruning, creating inefficient connections. Prescription opiates and street drugs like heroin are chemically and practically equivalent. They're particularly dangerous because they activate all opiate receptors simultaneously, especially in brain areas controlling breathing. Regular users experience learning difficulties, impaired decision-making, and cognitive damage from oxygen deprivation. Stimulants energize the body and brain while decreasing fatigue and producing euphoria through massive dopamine releases. These drugs trick cleanup molecules to work in reverse, flooding synapses with dopamine. With continued use, stimulant users develop repetitive behaviors and engage in manic, productive work that's often flawed. Chronic methamphetamine use permanently alters the brain in ways similar to premature aging, cruelly reducing users' ability to experience natural pleasure. Addiction crosses all demographics. No parent can safely say, "Not my kid." Between 8-33% of middle and high schoolers drink monthly, 10% use illegal drugs, 18% binge drink, and teens are the biggest abusers of prescription medications. Most addicted kids are caught in a cycle of self-medicating pain, anxiety, and trauma. Substance abuse disorders are genetically influenced conditions, with genes explaining up to 60% of addiction risk. The remaining 40% comes from environment and epigenetics. Addiction isn't passed solely through DNA, but through epigenetics, how environmental factors chemically alter gene expression without changing DNA itself. Trauma, exercise, sleep deprivation, diet, mental illness, and stress can all create epigenetic changes that affect addiction vulnerability. Addiction is truly a family disease, affecting everyone in the household through both genetic and environmental pathways. Children of addicted parents are primed for addiction through multiple mechanisms and more likely to become alcoholics themselves or marry alcoholics. These children adapt to chaos and learn experiential factors, essentially an education in managing addiction, keeping family secrets, and pretending everything is fine. Addiction is increasingly viewed as a developmental disorder, or what Dr. Daniel Sumruck calls ritualized compulsive comfort seeking, a predictable response to painful experiences. The CDC's Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACEs, revealed that childhood trauma dramatically increases addiction risk. Beyond the original ACEs, Dr. Burke Harris has expanded the list to include community violence, homelessness, discrimination, foster care, bullying, medical trauma, caregiver loss, deportation/migration, teen dating violence, and youth incarceration. Today's adolescents are America's most stressed demographic, with those aged 15 to 21 reporting alarming levels of anxiety. Physical symptoms like headaches, 30% of kids, and sleeplessness, 44%, often go unrecognized as anxiety indicators. This toxic stress alters brain architecture and stress response systems, disrupting learning. Children with four or more ACEs are 32.6 times more likely to develop learning and behavioral problems. Children struggling academically between ages 7 to 9 face significantly higher substance use risk by ages 14-15. Untreated ADHD particularly correlates with addiction. Up to 35% of cocaine users and 40% of alcoholics have underlying ADHD, making them twice as likely to abuse substances. While we can't change genetic inheritance, we can manage epigenetic and environmental risk factors when substance abuse affects a family. Key strategies include calling in reinforcements by getting counseling for all family members, banishing secrets and shame that tear families apart, talking openly about family risk, keeping addictive substances locked away, encouraging physical activity, which correlates with lower substance use rates, and getting a pet, as human-animal interactions improve mood, reduce stress, increase oxytocin, and often lead to more exercise. Self-efficacy. Children's belief in their ability to succeed and cope with challenges serves as a powerful protection against adverse childhood experiences. Parents can boost children's self-efficacy by helping them develop optimism. Optimistic children view setbacks as temporary, specific, and attributable to changeable behaviors, while pessimists see obstacles as permanent, pervasive, and their fault. Your child's pediatrician can be a crucial ally in substance abuse prevention. With 83% of adolescents getting yearly physicals, healthcare providers are ideally positioned to identify high-risk behaviors early. Most teens trust their doctors and are open to discussing risky behaviors when confidentiality is assured. School nurses and counselors serve as vital resources for physical and mental health support and screening. Mindfulness practices promote integration between brain regions, helping adolescents control impulses and process emotions. These practices create measurable changes in brain structures and connectivity, allowing teens to gain objectivity, lower physical stress responses, and develop interoceptive awareness, sensitivity to bodily sensations. This perspective shift helps teens see stressors as passing experiences rather than overwhelming crises. Rather than seeing stressful situations as purely negative, parents can help teens view challenges as opportunities for growth. Psychologist Dan Siegel suggests framing novel experiences, like moving to a new place, as positive outlets for adolescents' natural craving for novelty and dopamine-producing experiences. Adolescents need 8 to 10 hours of sleep nightly, but 4 out of 5 teens get less. Sleep deprivation creates a bidirectional relationship with substance abuse. Poor sleep increases substance use risk, while substances like alcohol disrupt sleep quality despite seeming like sedatives. Sleep deprivation weakens immunity, increases obesity risk, causes mood disorders, and impairs learning and memory consolidation. Diana Bomrin's research identified parenting styles that significantly impact adolescent substance use. Modern developmental psychologists categorize parenting as authoritarian, demanding but unresponsive, authoritative, demanding and responsive, neglectful, neither demanding nor responsive, or permissive, not demanding but highly responsive. Authoritative parenting produces the most addiction-resistant children, those who feel supported and connected while developing self-efficacy and competence. Authoritative parents use a "here's why" approach rather than "because I said so," requiring them to understand topics before explaining them to children. This includes understanding how substances affect developing brains to provide fact-based, persuasive information. Knowledge extends beyond monitoring location and activities to truly understanding children's goals, hopes, dreams, motivations, and fears, enabling proactive rather than reactive parenting. Family expectations encompass values, attitudes, beliefs, and norms, the standards family members hold each other to. These mutually agreed-upon expectations help everyone understand how to act and maintain accountability. Authoritative parents explain reasoning behind expectations, as rules without explanation become ineffective, especially as adolescents develop higher-order cognitive abilities. Practice is where knowledge and expectations merge into action and consequence. Effective parenting practices connect actions to natural consequences, fostering self-efficacy. When children make good decisions, they enjoy positive outcomes. Poor decisions bring consequences they must manage. Enforcing consequences isn't mean parenting, but prepares children for a world that won't make exceptions for them. Genetics account for about half of substance use disorder causation. If genetics are the loaded gun, childhood experiences are the trigger. This knowledge requires honest family discussion about addiction history. Parents should openly discuss family addiction history, establish clear expectations against underage drinking, and explain the heightened genetic risks their children may face. Siblings don't just share genetics, they share attitudes about substance use and powerfully influence each other. Research shows older siblings help shape family expectations around drugs and alcohol, sometimes undermining parental norms. Parents should capitalize on this influence by recruiting older siblings into prevention efforts, helping them understand their role as teachers and models. Leahy emphasizes that parents must initiate substance use conversations early and maintain them consistently. She advises parents to start early, as 29% of 12 to 14-year-olds report having close friends who use substances, keep discussions ongoing and age-appropriate, listen to children's attitudes about substances, create deliberate opportunities for conversation, begin difficult conversations immediately rather than postponing them, normalize regular discussions about substance use, and recognize that parents can discourage use even if they use substances themselves. For families with substance abuse history, communication requires special attention, since genetics account for about half of addiction risk. When children experiment with substances, rather than reacting with anger, ask about the experience and use it as an opportunity to explain the chemical reality of substance use, that every high creates a corresponding low. For preschoolers and kindergartners, prevention begins with teaching basic healthy behaviors like hand washing, toothbrushing, and proper nutrition. Parents should clearly communicate family expectations about substances while leveraging young children's love of counting, sorting, and storytelling to make these lessons engaging. As children enter elementary school, their attention spans lengthen and their understanding of biology deepens, allowing for more sophisticated health discussions. While they still respect parental authority, they begin testing independence and family expectations. Children at this age are increasingly exposed to substance use in media, with studies showing alcohol appearing in many G-PG movies and cartoons, requiring parents to contextualize these messages. Middle school represents the deep end of the pool for substance abuse prevention, as most kids who try addictive substances first do so during these years. Parents should emphasize how early substance use significantly increases addiction risk. Children starting in middle school face a 41% lifetime risk of substance dependence versus just 11% for those who wait until age 21. Adolescence presents the highest risk period for substance use, making prevention efforts crucial but challenging as teens test boundaries. Family expectations inevitably face challenges as teens push boundaries to test their durability. Open communication becomes their essential lifeline through this period. When teens trust parents to remain supportive, even during difficult conversations, they're more likely to be honest. The research on peer influence is more nuanced than the simple "bad kids corrupt good kids" narrative parents fear. Adolescent friendships form through proximity in childhood, but shift towards shared interests and identity exploration during teen years. Kids likely to use substances often seek each other out rather than merely influencing innocent peers. Parents can help children develop healthy peer relationships by being emotionally responsive from infancy, modeling positive friendships, and discussing relationship qualities. Specific strategies include asking children to envision ideal friendships, discussing their actual relationships dynamics, modeling self-respect by ending toxic relationships, highlighting examples of empathy and kindness, knowing their friends' parents, and helping children develop strong identities that make them less susceptible to negative peer pressure. Practical strategies for resisting peer pressure include teaching kids that no thanks is often sufficient, correcting misperceptions about how many peers actually use substances, and providing various excuses they can use, volunteering as designated driver, having a secret signal with friends/parents to indicate needing to leave, claiming family addiction history, citing alcohol allergies or medication interactions, mentioning sleep disorders, holding non-alcoholic drinks to blend in, using weight watching as an excuse, and ensuring they know they can call for a ride anytime without judgment. Schools play a critical role in addiction prevention, yet often miss opportunities to effectively intervene before problems escalate. Modern school health programs began in 1850 with public health initiatives in schools, expanding 50 years later when the first school nurse was hired in New York City. Today's school nurses improve attendance, care for chronically ill students, and boost immunization rates. Despite their importance, only 57% of high schools implement substance abuse prevention programs, and a mere 10% of those use evidence-based approaches. Early programs like DARE and Just Say No not only failed, but sometimes proved counterproductive, with participants more likely to make unhealthy substance choices than students who received no education at all. Effective substance abuse prevention should begin as early as preschool by promoting healthy habits and identifying social-emotional delays. Programs should emphasize pro-social behaviors like sharing, helping others, and empathy, traits that not only improve school performance but reduce risk factors like childhood aggression. Elementary school prevention programs build on preschool foundations by continuing to promote pro-social skills while adding stress management, mindfulness, conflict resolution, and self-advocacy training. School connectedness becomes increasingly important. When children feel safe and cared for at school, they're less likely to engage in risky behaviors. Middle school represents a critical juncture where prevention meets intervention, as many adolescents begin contemplating or experimenting with substances. Effective programs continue building social and communication skills while emphasizing decision-making, refusal skills, and correcting misperceptions about peer substance use. High school prevention programs focus on reinforcing self-management, self-awareness, relationship skills, and responsible decision-making as students prepare for college, work, and adulthood. These transitions bring higher stakes, more serious consequences, and increased stress. Developmentally, breaking rules and drinking to excess makes perfect sense during adolescence, especially in college when young adults live away from home while remaining financially dependent on parents. This period represents the confusing push and pull of individuation, the process of separating from parents and establishing independent identity. Perception drives reality on college campuses through pluralistic ignorance. Despite stereotypes of excessive college drinking, studies revealed students privately felt uncomfortable with campus drinking culture, but believed their peers were more comfortable with it. This misconception perpetuates alcohol-centered social events. Understanding standard drink measurements is crucial: 12 ounces for beer, 5 ounces for wine, and 1.5 ounces for spirits, amounts an average body can process in 1 hour. While about 44% of college students drink alcohol, averaging 5 drinks weekly, this statistic is misleading. The heaviest drinking students consume 68% of all campus alcohol, with binge drinkers consuming 72% of all alcohol. The heaviest college drinkers are white men under 24, Greek system residents, and student athletes, particularly in high-contact sports. Meanwhile, 56% of students don't binge drink and consume just 9% of campus alcohol. African Americans, Asians, older students, married students, academically focused students, and volunteers drink less. Understanding why students drink helps target prevention efforts. Those who drink to cope emotionally rather than socially face greater risks and consequences. Most college binge drinkers don't continue heavy drinking after graduation, similar to Vietnam soldiers who used heroin during war but stopped upon returning home. The exception, those who drink for emotional reasons rather than social ones, often develop long-term problems. Parents should approach substance use conversations with respect and trust, which encourages better decision-making. When discussing substance use with college-bound students, consider these conversation starters: the drinking culture at their chosen school, housing choices, athletic involvement, substance-free housing options, your own college experiences without glamorizing, practicing refusal scripts, debunking myths about sobering up, addressing the reality of lax enforcement of underage drinking laws, revisiting how substances affect developing brains, gender differences in alcohol processing, and the special dangers of drinking games. Despite our hopes for our students and children, we cannot guarantee their sobriety or success. We can only offer our love and support. Years later, Leahy discovered that Georgia, a former student she'd nicknamed My Little Spider after Whitman's poem, had finally graduated college at 36. Her Facebook photo showed her healthy, beautiful, and most importantly, happy. She had finally cast a thread that caught somewhere, saving herself when no one else could. Georgia's story exemplifies how recovery can happen at any age, often when least expected, and sometimes after multiple attempts. The most powerful message in addiction prevention is that it's never too late. While early intervention offers the best outcomes, recovery remains possible even after years of struggle. Research shows that approximately 75% of people who struggle with addiction eventually recover, though their paths may be non-linear and include multiple attempts. Success stories range from teenagers who find sobriety through early intervention to adults who transform their lives after decades of substance use. Understanding the complex interplay of genetics, environment, and developmental factors that contribute to addiction risk enables parents and educators to create protective environments. This includes recognizing that children with family histories of addiction need extra support, but their genetic predisposition doesn't seal their fate. Environmental factors like stable home life, strong community connections, and positive peer relationships can significantly offset genetic risks. Through authoritative parenting, open communication, strong school partnerships, and consistent messaging about substances, we can help the next generation navigate the challenges of adolescence without turning to chemical solutions. Effective strategies include regular family dinners and quality time that build trust and connection, clear, age-appropriate discussions about substance use and family history, involvement in extracurricular activities that promote healthy coping skills, strong partnerships between parents, schools, and community organizations. The science is clear. Prevention works, and even children with significant risk factors can thrive when given the right support and tools to build resilience. Studies show that every dollar invested in prevention saves up to $10 in treatment costs later. Success stories from recovery communities demonstrate that transformation is possible at any stage, whether someone is 16 or 60. The key is maintaining hope while providing consistent support, understanding that recovery often happens gradually, with small victories accumulating into lasting change.